is Tuesday, May 26th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. South Korea aims to launch its first nuclear-powered submarine by the mid-2030s and deploy it by the late 2030s. More on that in News Briefing. On In Depth, we discuss the Starbucks Korea Tank Day controversy, the historical references that sparked outrage, and how the backlash has become a political issue ahead of the June 3rd elections. And on Hallyu Highlights, we look at HYBE's new girl group lineup, Stray Kids tour dates, and the Starbucks scandal spilling into Korean entertainment. Let's start Korea 24 right now. The government on Tuesday unveiled its first official roadmap for the development of nuclear-powered submarines. It's aiming to launch its first nuclear-powered submarine by the mid-2030s. Our KBS World Radio News reporter, Bae Ji-yeon, joins us now in the studio to give us the latest on this story and other headlines of the day. Hello, Ji-yeon.
Hello, Alana.
Did the government's roadmap mention any date for the deployment of this submarine?
It sure did. It plans to deploy it to the Navy by the late 2030s. Defense Minister An Kyu-baek unveiled the goal on Tuesday as he disclosed a basic plan on developing nuclear-powered submarines during a meeting at the Navy's Submarine Force Command, which was also attended by President Lee Jae-myung. An said the envisioned submarine's reactor will be powered by low-enriched uranium with an enrichment level of less than 20%. He added that the submarine will be designed to make long-cycle operation possible to minimize the need for refueling.
And I understand that the submarine will be built independently using South Korea's own nuclear reactor and shipbuilding technology.
That's right. The defense minister made that point very clear. Take note that the government has steadfastly adhered to the stance of building a nuclear power submarine at home since South Korea and the U.S. reached an agreement on the issue during summit talks in October last year.
Now, shifting gears to North Korea, the reclusive state fired multiple ballistic missiles toward the Yellow Sea today. Ji-yeon, what do we know?
Well, according to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, North Korea launched close-range ballistic missiles at around 1 p.m. Tuesday from the Jeonju area in North Pyongan province. The JCS said the missiles flew about 80 kilometers, adding that multiple types of projectiles were detected. Seoul has closely shared related information with Washington and Tokyo under their three-way security cooperation, and the JCSS has begun analyzing details and the maximum range of the projectiles.
And when was the last time that North Korea fired ballistic missiles?
That would be on April 19th. It fired multiple short-range ballistic missiles toward the East Sea from Simpo, South Hamgyong province, which it claimed had carried a cluster bomb warhead. The latest firing was the North's eighth ballistic missile launch this year.
Has there been any response from the South Korean government on Tuesday's missile launch?
In a briefing, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Park Il said Seoul again calls for the North's cooperation with South Korea's policy to establish peace on the Korean Peninsula and ease tensions in the region. Park said South Korea will continue to exert efforts to make headway in addressing North Korea issues via a phased practical approach in close cooperation with the international community while pursuing its goal of realizing the complete denuclearization of the peninsula.
Moving on now, we've talked about the recent marketing campaign at Starbucks Korea that invited public outrage by bringing up painful memories of the Gwangju Democratic Uprising. And we're going to delve more into that controversy in our in-depth segment. Today, Chung Young-jin, chairman of Shinsegae Group, which licenses and operates Starbucks Korea, issued a public apology over the campaign. Ji-yeon, give us the details.
The chairman of Shinsegae Group bowed his head in front of cameras Tuesday, apologizing for the marketing campaign that evoked painful memories of the brutal military crackdown on pro-democracy protesters in 1980. He also offered apologies to the bereaved families of the Democratic Uprising and to the South Korean people. Starbucks Korea launched an online Tumblr promotion called Tank Day on the anniversary of the May 18th democratization movement in Gwangju, which the government brutally crushed with tanks and paratroopers. The marketing campaign featured discounts on the company's tank tumblers and the slogan, quote, "Thwack it on your desk."
I understand that other than the tumbler's name, this slogan enraged many South Koreans. Why is that?
because it evoked the tortured death of student activist Park Jong-chul at the hands of the Seoul police in 1987 and the lie the police told to cover up their actions, saying the young man dropped dead when an officer slammed a desk with a thwack. Amid public backlash, Jung earlier dismissed Starbucks Korea CEO Son Jung-hyun.
Global superstars BTS won the American Music Awards Artist of the Year at this year's ceremony in Las Vegas, while K-pop Demon Hunters took home Song of the Year for their hit Golden, adding to its long list of accolades. Jian, give us all the details.
BTS was a major highlight at the 52nd American Music Awards held at the MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas on Monday, as all seven members made their highly anticipated return to a U.S. awards show following their military service. Their fans, the BTS Army, were in the audience, erupting in deafening cheers to support them, especially when they won the top prize of the night, Artist of the Year, beating out the likes of Bruno Mars, Justin Bieber, and Lady Gaga. Let's listen to what BTS member RM said in accepting the top honor.
Thank you. It's an honor to have this precious award once again after everybody done their military service. Biggest thanks and gratitude, as always, goes to the armies all over the world who stood by us for the past 13 years. Thank you so much.
And Jian, this marks the second time BTS has won the top award at the AMAs, right?
Yes, the first time being in 2021 when they made history as the first Asian act to do so with their hit song Butter. The latest feat comes some 2 months after the seven-member group released its fifth album, Arirang. Marking another milestone for K-pop, Song of the Year went to Golden, the widely popular tune from the Netflix animated movie K-pop Demon Hunters, and was accepted by its real-life vocalists Lee and Rae Ami. Let's listen to what Lee said.
Truly, like, this movie and this song is fueled by the fans. You guys sealed the whole moon. So yeah, the fact that this vote is voted by the fans, like, that's what means so much. So thank you so much to the fans.
Golden, which was also named Best Pop Song, is now a full-fledged crossover hit following earlier wins at the Oscars, the Grammys, and the Golden Globes.
And that's how we'll wrap up today's news briefing. Thanks so much, Jian, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thanks, Alana.
Hi, my name is Jocelyn Clark. I'm the first official non-Korean licensee of Gayagam Sanjo in Korea. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
What began as a coffee chain promotion has spiraled into a national controversy in South Korea. On May 18th, Starbucks Korea caused a political scandal with the release of its Tank Day Tumblr promotion event, seen by many as touching the deepest wounds in Korean history, the 1980 Gwangju Democratic Uprising, a democratic movement that was violently suppressed by the Chun Doo-hwan military dictatorship. The sounds you're hearing are from a press conference today, where Shinsegae chairman Chung Yong-jin publicly apologized for the campaign, while Starbucks Korea CEO Son Jung-hyun was dismissed, and both now face criminal complaints. Shinsegae has been drawn into the controversy as Starbucks Korea is operated by its affiliate, SCK Company. The public reaction has been fierce, with boycott calls spreading online and some consumers posting videos of themselves destroying Starbucks products. And with the June 3rd elections just days away, the controversy has become a campaign issue as well. To help us understand the historical triggers behind the campaign, the public outrage and the political fallout, we're joined today on the line by Korea Jeongang Daily reporter Seo Ji-yeon. Hello, Ms. Seo.
Hello, thank you for having me.
We're also joined on the line by Professor Yang Myung-ji, a political sociologist specializing in contentious politics at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Great to have you with us, Professor Yang.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, before we bring in Professor Yang for the broader historical and political context, let's first establish exactly what happened. Ms. Saw, tell us about the Starbucks campaign. Why did it trigger such a strong reaction?
So on May 18th, Starbucks Korea launched a promotion for a new large capacity tumbler. They call it the Tank Tumbler. The campaign used two phrases, Tank Day and Bang on the Desk. And the date was May 18th, which is the anniversary of the Gwangju Democratic Movement in Korea. And that combination set off an immediate and very strong reaction. People saw those words on that specific date and were furious. Starbucks pulled the campaign within hours, but by then it had already spread widely online and the damage was done.
Now, Ms. Seo, for listeners who are maybe a bit less familiar with Korean modern history, why exactly did the phrases Tank Day and Bang on the Desk provoke this strong reaction? And why did the May 18th timing make it even more sensitive?
Right, so the context is everything here. May 18th, 1980, pro-democracy protesters rose up in the southwestern city of Gwangju against the military junta that had seized power. And the military response was brutal. Paratroopers and tanks were sent in. Hundreds of people were killed. And it remains one of the most painful chapters in modern Korean history. And Gwangju has become a symbol of what ordinary Koreans sacrifice for democracy. So Tank Day on May 18th, with the date 5/18 printed right next to it on the graphic, was not read as a fun Tumblr event. But people read it as a reference to the tanks that killed people in Gwangju. And Bang on the Desk carries its own history as well. In 1987, a university student named Park Chung-chul was arrested and tortured to death by police. And when authorities tried to cover it up, an official told a press briefing that the student had simply banged on the desk and died. And that line became a symbol of state brutality and the denial that followed it. Something Koreans who lived through that era remember very specifically. So both phrases together on that date, a lot of people felt it couldn't have been an accident. And even if it was, the carelessness itself was seen as deeply disrespectful.
In response to this backlash, as we heard in our intro, Shinseki Chairman Chung Young-in, he issued another apology Tuesday morning. This is in addition to an initial written apology. Ms. Saul, what exactly did he say?
So Chairman Chung appeared in person this morning at the Joseon Palace Hotel in Gangnam, which is his first public appearance since the scandal broke 8 days ago. He bowed his head and said, I'm paraphrasing here, "All responsibility lies with me. It is my fault. I will make no excuses." He committed to making today's apology not an end but a beginning, and said the company would make real changes through actions and not words. Alongside the apology, Shinsegae also released the findings of its internal investigation, and the results are pretty damning, even if the company says it found no evidence of deliberate intent. According to the investigation, the Tank Day campaign was first proposed by Starbucks Korea's commerce team and went through four stages of approval: the team leader, manager, division head, and all the way up to the CEO. And not a single person raised a concern at any stage. Shinsegae's executive vice president summed it up by saying the incident revealed a lack of social and historical sensitivity within Starbucks Korea, and serious flaws in its risk management system. The company also said it found no clear evidence that employees intentionally planned this to mock the May 18th movement. But for a lot of people, that almost made it worse, that the idea that this went through four layers of approval and nobody thought twice about it.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Seo, what has the public reaction been like?
So it has been very intense. On the boycott side, people have been posting videos of themselves smashing Starbucks mugs and tumblers, and guides spread online explaining how to get refunds from prepaid Starbucks gift cards. Photos of empty Starbucks stores in Gwangju went viral. And the Kakao gift card rankings, where Starbucks used to hold the top two spots consistently, showed It had dropped to sixth place within days of the controversy. And the apology hasn't really settled things. The response online has stayed largely critical, and calls for a boycott have actually expanded to other Shinsegae affiliates as well. But there's also been a counter-reaction that's also worth mentioning. Some conservative users started going to Starbucks specifically as a political statement and posting photos of themselves holding cups using hashtags like anti-communist coffee. And a term started circulating online called 멸공복스 in Korean, combining the Starbucks name with 멸공, which means the anti-communist slogan. And one post replaced the Taeguk symbol on the Korean flag with the Starbucks logo and called it a patriotic reward. So at a certain point, Starbucks stopped being just a coffee controversy, and going there or refusing to became a way of signaling which side you're on politically.
Professor Yang, I want to turn to you now to help us understand a bit more the historical context behind this backlash. Could you tell us what is at the root of the outrage over this campaign?
Okay, thank you for the question. I think this is not like random incident. People, it was concerning sign that there are some segments of people in South Korea that try to dismiss, disrespect South Korea's democracy and its achievement. And as Ms. So said, you know, it was May 18 anniversary, and then this big corporation used the symbol that dismiss the democratic symbols. So it was very concerning sign that demonstrates, you know, some people could ridicule democratic movements and its achievement in South Korea. So I think people's strong reaction is against this democratic decline or far-right waves that is happening right now in South Korea. But, you know, this cannot be a random incident mm-hmm. that suddenly happened at the as of, like, 2026. You know, last few months or, like, last few decades, since South Korea's democratic transition, there have been rise of far-right movement and politics in South Korea, especially since the December 3rd Marshall Law Declaration made by former President Yoon Suk-yeol. And then since then, there was a strong far-right movement named Yoon Again. And then these guys explicitly denied democratic principles, and they employed hate speech and violence, as we have seen in January 19 attack of Western Courthouse last year. So I think, you know, this incident is related to former far-right movements and accident. And then a lot of people were really concerned about what is going on in South politics. And I think, you know, the strong reaction is related to previous incident as well. Yeah.
Right. So, Professor Yang, in your view, this is not just a random incident, but part of a much broader trend. Professor Yang, can you tell us more about May 18th? How does that history play into political dynamics in Korea? And how does it affect people's political views?
Okay. Yeah. So I think Ms. So already explained about May 18th pretty well. But, you know, that was, you know, very explicit state violence. Obviously, you know, military Jeonduan regime blockaded city of Gwangju for 10 days, and then they targeted the city. They killed innocent civilians. And then, you know, back in 1980, it was not like nowadays, you know, all the media was censored by the military government. So the rest of the nation didn't know what was going on in the city. And then after the massacre, the military Jeon regime announced that, like, they successfully suppressed the communist riot that had happened in Gwangju. And, you know, many people believe that the communist riot was cracked down by this military regime, and then South Korean society restored social order thanks to military government. That was the information that the military government spread to the nation. But obviously, there were handful number of journalists and then witnesses, and then, you know, some people, especially college students, knew about what happened in Gwangju. And then this incident was very explicit state violence, you know, to legitimate their rule. They targeted one city, killed civilians, and then they blamed the innocent citizens. Mm-hmm. But it inspired a lot of student activists, and then a lot of student activists couldn't tolerate this violence, and then they became student activists to fight against military dictatorship. So after 8 years, obviously, you know, a lot of people participated in pro-democracy protests, and eventually in 1987, South Korean society achieved a democratic transition. So this was very symbolic, important political event that contributed to South Korea's democracy.
Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to describe what happened in Gwangju in 1980 as a real turning point in South Korean democracy. Professor Yang, what are some other examples in Korea where political scandals or even extremist rhetoric have triggered similar public anger over painful historical events? And more broadly, what do these reactions tell us about how Korean society remembers and still debates its democratic history?
Okay. I think similar issues happened before. So I think the good examples would be April 3rd Jeju uprising, or recently like comfort women issues. So there have been a small segment of extreme right-wing intellectuals or individuals that distorted historical facts. So for example, for Jeju uprising, they some people or some influencers argue that like this event was communist rebellions, and then the Isungman regime basically repressed or suppressed these communist rebels. So it was justified. That was their argument. For the comfort women issues during the Japanese colonial era, some extreme right-wing influencers argue that, like, you know, comfort women were not forced. There was no state involvement. Rather, these women, these victims, were voluntary prostitutes that had legitimate contract. So this type of arguments were not very influential, but in the last decade, it has become more and more acceptable, especially in the internet space, thanks to social media like KakaoTalk or YouTube videos. In the past, this type of argument was not acceptable publicly, but with social media, with almost no strong regulation, people can tell anything to the public. So this type of distorted arguments could be more and more, like, you know, easily spread. And these people are also, like, you know, publishing books, etc. So it's not yet mainstream, but I see that they are pushing the boundaries and further and further. And then some people are accepting these distorted facts nowadays. The different thing about Starbucks incident, I think, you know, often these comfort women issues or Jeju uprising issues, it was fringe discourse disseminated in some parts of internet, but Starbucks basically made public advertisement or campaign. So they actually brought the issue in the upfront very, like, publicly. So that's why people were very shocked and surprised. And then it had huge backlash against Starbucks Korea, I think.
Right. Just to reiterate.
But it is very concerning, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Once this thing is allowed, one after another, more and more people can ridicule this type of, like, historical trauma. And if it is accepted in the public, like, the boundaries can be pushed further and further, and, extreme discourses could be more mainstream. I think that is the biggest concern that we are facing at this point.
Mm-hmm. And just to reiterate for our listeners outside of the country, as you said, Professor Yang, this controversy really is sweeping the nation. Ms. Saul, I want to turn back to you now for a moment. Beyond the public backlash, this controversy now appears to be shaping the campaign ahead of the June 3rd local elections. What have politicians been saying about the Starbucks campaign, and how has the controversy become an election issue?
Right, so it has become a major one. President Lee Jae-myung came out almost immediately calling the campaign an insult to the bloodstained struggle of the Gwangju victims and demanding moral, administrative, legal, and political accountability. He later escalated further, linking it to a separate Starbucks Korea promotion from 2 years ago, a siren mug event that happened to fall on April 16th, which was actually the anniversary of the Sewol ferry disaster. He called that beastly conduct. So the framing from the ruling side has been that this isn't an isolated marketing campaign, but it's part of a pattern of commercial exploitation of national tragedies. And on the government side, multiple ministries also joined the boycott officially. The Interior Ministry, for example, said it would no longer use Starbucks products at official events. The Justice Ministry asked prosecutors to review their use of Starbucks gift cards. And Gwangju City also joined. The Democratic Party told its election candidates and campaign workers to stay away from Starbucks. But then the People Power Party pushed back hard. So the PPP leader Jang Dong-hyuk called the government-level boycott a collective bullying led by the president and argued it amounted to another form of state violence. He also pointed out that police had started scrutinizing civil servants' personal Starbucks purchase records, which he said crossed the line. And some PPP members went further. So some candidates posted videos of themselves at Starbucks, framing it as taking a stand for conservative values.
Now, a civic group has also filed a police complaint against Shinsegae chairman Chung Young-jin and former Starbucks Korea CEO Sun Jung-hyun. Ms. So, what are they accusing them of, and what law are they citing in connection with the May 18th Gwangju democratization movement?
So there are two complaints that have been merged into one investigation. Both allege insult and defamation, the argument being that using Tank Day and bang on the desk on the anniversary of the uprising constitutes a direct insult to the victims and their families. One complaint also invokes the special act on the May 18th democratization movement, which was enacted in 2021. So under that law, spreading false information about the movement can carry up to 5 years in prison. And the Seoul Metropolitan Police Agency is now handling the investigation. Both Chairman Jung and former CEO Son have been formally registered as suspects, though that's standard procedure when a complaint is filed and not an indication that wrongdoing has actually been established. No summons for questioning has been issued yet.
Well, that's all that we have time for today. My thanks to Seo Ji-eun from the Korea Jungang Daily for walking us through the Starbucks controversy and its legal and political fallout. Thank you so much, Ms. Seo.
Thank you.
And to Professor Yang Myung-ji of the University of Hawaii at Manoa for helping us understand the deeper historical context behind the public reaction. Thank you so much, Professor Yang.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 199.8 points, or 2.55% on Tuesday, to close at 8,047.51. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 11.39 points, or 0.98%, to close at 1,172.52. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Alana.
Daniel, what's our starting point today?
Park Hang-seo, who played an integral coaching role in South Korea's miraculous run to the semifinals in the 2002 World Cup and celebrated in Vietnam as a figure who elevated the country's football to new heights, is taking on a brand new challenge over in Thailand this time.
So from Korea to Vietnam and now Thailand, he really has become one of the most recognizable coaching names in Asian football. What exactly will his new role be there?
So on Monday, various Thai media outlets reported that Park would take charge of Kanchanaburi Power FC as their new head coach. He has looked to help guide the team currently competing in Thai League 2 to claw back up to the top-tier league. Other than it's a two-year contract, no details on salary and other aspects have been disclosed yet.
And have we heard from Park about his reasons for taking on this new role?
Well, it's especially surprising to football fans as there were even rumors of him retiring from coaching altogether. Park said in a recent interview with Thai media that he was deeply moved by the long-term vision and sincerity toward football shown by Kanchanaburi. He also wanted to take on this challenge as there have been no previous standout instances of foreign coaches blazing trails and helping teams reach new heights in Thailand.
And will he be jumping straight into this Thai job or does he have other commitments to wrap up first?
Well, since stepping down as Vietnam national team head coach in 2023, following his historic success where he led the team to multiple regional achievements and transformed the country's football landscape, he turned down various coaching offers from Vietnam and Korea. He took on multiple responsibility to work as a senior advisor for Bac Ninh FC in Vietnam's first division, while also operating a football academy in that country. He is expected to travel with South Korea's delegation for the 2026 FIFA World Cup, as he currently serves as vice president of the Korea Football Association. So for now, assistant coach Lee Jong-soo will temporarily oversee Kanchanaburi.
Park has built such a strong legacy, so it'll be fascinating to see whether he can have a similar impact in Thailand. Let's move on now to our next story.
Perfect Crown, which enjoyed rave reviews and incredible popularity but also stirred some controversy, it is trending today with a public petition to remove the show posted on the National Assembly's electronic petition platform, gaining over 50,000 signatures as of Tuesday.
Well, we've seen other dramas use fictionalized royal settings before. What was so different about Perfect Crown? What specific elements, you know, sparked this strong public anger?
Some critics say there were insufficient explanations of the continued existence of the Korean monarchy from the Joseon Dynasty. There were historically inaccurate portrayals of traditional Joseon Dynasty costume in episode 11. The show producers clothed the Grand Prince in a crown that suggests Korea was not a sovereign state or monarchy, but a vassal state of Imperial China. Court members in the coronation scene also were shouting "Chunse," meaning 1,000 years, rather than "Manse," meaning 10,000 years, which critics say implies China's imperial presence there again. Some said the scene lent credence to China's Northeast Project, a campaign to include parts of Korean Peninsula within China's historical territories.
And Daniel, can you give us the details of what's being demanded through this public petition?
The public petition posted last Friday noted that Perfect Crown distorted Korean culture and history through the use of Chinese elements in the show, including scenes involving ceremonies and various changes, and demanded that the show be removed from being aired and to halt streaming it via VODs or OTTs or other forms. The petitioner also demanded a system to permanently remove contents that display historical distortion or stir historical controversy. Having gained over 50,000 signatures, it surpasses the threshold to be referred to a standing committee for further review.
And what kind of response have we been getting from those involved in the production following this controversy?
The lead actors IU and Byun Woo-seok issued public apologies via social media. Director Park Jun-ha, in an interview on Tuesday, acknowledged the controversy and expressed regret on behalf of the screenwriters. Both the director and screenwriter also separately apologized, and the show's co-producer announced plans to delete controversial scenes.
Well, it really highlights how sensitive historical imagery can be in Korea, even in fiction, and how quickly a drama controversy can become a national issue. Let's now turn to our final story of the day.
A village in Changwon, South Gyeongsang Province, reported harvesting a massive watermelon weighing over 23 kilograms.
Okay, Daniel, let's put into perspective just how massive this watermelon actually is.
According to the city government in Changwon, Tuesday, the 23.63 kilogram watermelon harvested at a farm in Walim Village is easily more than twice the size of a typical watermelon sold in stores, as its ordinary counterparts weigh between 5 and 10 kilograms.
Wow, so absolutely huge. Should we hear from the green-thumbed genius behind this sweet behemoth?
He is Yun Jung-won, a veteran farmer who has grown watermelons, tomatoes and other crops for about 30 years on his 14,000 square meter farm. He has been the watermelon grower to beat at various watermelon contests held in the region, coming out on top in 2018 and 2019. He gave credit to Mother Nature, saying this year's weather conditions were favorable, and said it is rewarding to see his watermelon grow big and sweet.
And is this super watermelon still around, or did Mr. Yoon chop it up and tuck into it?
Well, it is for now fully intact and on display through the week for visitors to behold. Yoon, who also serves as the village head, donated the watermelon to the local administrative welfare center, as he believes it would help promote the quality of watermelons grown in the area and the cultivation skills of local farmers.
So not just a sweet snack, but a source of local pride. That's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Broadway actor Hwang Joo-min. Now you're listening to KBS World Radio.
It's that time again, Hallyu Highlights, your weekly scoop on everything hot in Korean entertainment, from the latest K-pop hits to the K-dramas everyone's binging. And as usual, we're joined today in the studio by our resident K-culture expert, Bernie Cho. Bernie, great to have you with us.
Always good to be back.
Well, Bernie, big day for K-pop today with the 52nd American Music Awards taking place earlier today at the MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas. We've already covered the big winners of the day in our news briefing. But Bernie, tell us about the big performance of the night.
Yes, it's an occupational hazard as much as I need to and we need to talk about who are the nominees, who are the winners. Part of my job, although it was never written, is to talk about the live performances. Mm-hmm. Who killed it, who crushed it, who might have, you know, may have had slipped up a bit. But it's safe to say Cat's Eye has been an absolute role, moving from festivals to award shows to the big stages, picking up a few awards along the way. And it has been fantastic. And more importantly, for HYBE, this is really proof of concept that their sort of formula of training artists of multinational descent, of multi-genre backgrounds, is not only working, but winning. And I think this is the tee up for the next story that we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I've heard that performance by Cat's Eye being described as a dream performance, and some of the visuals are just amazing. So generating plenty of buzz already. And a new act generating plenty of buzz before even making its debut, with HYBE producing a growing roster of commercially successful and critically acclaimed acts across different countries and genres. Expectations have been high for its latest girl group project, Saint Satine. Now, the lineup is complete. HYBE has announced the group's fourth and final member. It is Japanese teenager Sakura Tobi bringing the pre-debut speculation to an end. Bernie, why is her story so inspirational?
Well, this is the thing. With Cat's Eye, this band was put together vis-a-vis through not just an audition program, but also this was a very well-watched program. It was called The Debut, appropriately enough, Dream Academy. Now, the thing is that three of the four girls that were picked for the new girl band actually were originally seen from this particular show. So, you know, the fact that three of the members who didn't quite make the cut for Cat's Eye, but that's okay. They got a second round and a second chance. So it obviously begged the question, who is the fourth member? Because, mm-hmm. again, they did go through an audition process. And it turns out with a 14,000 to 1 odds, she was a bit of a surprise because she's not only a 16-year-old girl from Japan, but from a very small town, Toyama, Japan. And she came through the show called World Scout, The Final Place, which was done with HYBE and Geffen Records. So from this one audition show, they only picked one girl, Sakura Tobi. Now, only she, like I said, small-town girl from Japan who's only 16 years old. This is the kicker, and this is what I think got a lot of people's attention, is the fact that she never really professionally or publicly trained to be a singer or a dancer. She did this all by herself, whether it was practicing by herself or dancing in front of a mirror by herself, and yet teaching herself, no less, singing and dancing before going on this audition program is truly amazing. Now, obviously, she put out a video as part of the audition process online to get some attention. But the fact that a self-taught, self-trained young woman was able to go this far and beat competition from around the world speaks volumes. And so right now, she's currently doing a bunch of interviews in a bunch of media outlets. But it's really fascinating to hear her process because it's so unconventional, mm-hmm. untraditional, that it really, I think, creates a lot of not just inspiration, perhaps maybe aspirations that for those who want to become a not just K-pop star, but a pop star, you may not necessarily have to go to all these different training academies. Passion with a lot of practice, with obviously a bit of good luck, could actually take you there. Mm-hmm. So she's going to be an interesting one to watch, an interesting one to see, an interesting one to follow, an interesting one to fanboy or fangirl over.
It's an incredible story, a true underdog story. And I have to say, I think that those bands that come from those audition programs, I mean, I'm just speculating here, but I think that they tend to do really well because the fans are so invested in that process of watching them through the whole audition progress, you know, picking their favorites, watching these bands being formed. So fingers crossed for her and for the entire, excuse me, the entire band that, you know, they do really well. We'll move on to our next story now. Stray Kids have been making headlines for both difficult and exciting tour news. We'll start with the bad news. On the downside, member Sungmin was recently diagnosed with a left ankle stress fracture, meaning he's gonna have to sit out the group's upcoming headlining performance at the Governor's Ball Music Festival in New York on June 7th. So really disappointing for him. I'm sure fans will be so disappointed. They will have something to look forward to, though, because Stray Kids have announced new Latin America tour dates for September. And this time, they won't just be headlining concerts. They'll also be taking the stage at festivals. So, Bernie, tell us a bit more about this new tour format.
Well, first, we have to pay a little bit of attention to Sungmin. This is obviously a huge disappointment, not only for him, but more importantly for the fans. But, you know, when you drop bad news like that, you know, the fans are not going to be happy. But my goodness, credit to JYP. They figured out a way to make some lemonade from this lemon of a news, which is, oh, yes, he's going to be hurt, but he'll be back on his feet again when they go back on tour in the fall. Now, Stray Kids, as we've talked about many times over the weeks, over the months, and probably for the past year or so, they've been breaking records mm-hmm. every time they drop a new album, but not just breaking records with the music they're putting out, but breaking records with the attendance numbers that they've been driving around the world. Impressive. Now, they have decided that when they go back on the road, It's coming in with a bit of a twist. It's not a concert tour. It's not festival headlining. It's a little of both, a lot of both, actually. And I have to say, it is absolutely, utterly genius. The concept and the format is number one. In the fall, in September, they're going to be hitting Latin America, as we know, has become a major market for K-pop. Now, this is where they decided to get a bit creative with their partners in crime, Live Nation. Mm. The tour is called Stray City, but it is not a Stray Kids concert tour. It's a mini festival tour, with Stray Kids being the headliner, but more importantly, JYP label mates Next, N-E-X-Z, will be performing. And this is actually long overdue. Usually when K-pop superstar acts go on their own, it's just them, and only them. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they have some of their emerging artists jump on as an opening act, that is common, normal, standard, even recommended on Western pop star tours. So the fact that K-pop act has decided to do that, great. But they decided to go, let's go better. And what they've done is, on top of the headliner Stray Kids and the opening act Next, they are tacking on two extra acts, local acts from each country, each city. So on September 9th in Bogota, Colombia, in addition to Stray Kids and Next, there will be Andres Obregón and Renee. The next stop, September 14th in Buenos Aires, Argentina, they will have opening acts Bad Milk, which I think is a great name, and Kai Lynch. And in Mexico City, I think it's Chaos, but it looks like K4OS and Cocho are going to be the opening joint acts for this particular mini festival tour. And JYP Entertainment and Live Nation have also posted out there that this isn't just a one-time, two-time, three-time thing. More cities, more dates are going to be announced. So I think this has to be one of the more creative tours put out there, and long overdue. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me to see an opening act for K-pop act, I thought was something that should have been done a long time ago, but they've decided to go one, two steps further, having local acts also open. And I think this is a great way for K-pop to become not just a one-way ticket, but more of a two-way exchange. And I think it will do wonders for boosting both the local appeal of local artists, but the global appeal of K-pop artists. So kudos, hats off, applause all around. This is, I think, utterly, absolutely brilliant. And I tell the truth, I hope to see a little bit more of this because, yeah, I think that Stray Kids is going to sell out. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they're bringing others along for the ride, I think, is fantastic.
Absolutely. It sounds like such a fun format. And Bernie, as you said, from a marketing perspective, it makes total sense for those fans of the local artists to potentially be exposed to Stray Kids and obviously vice versa, you know?
Yeah, and look, this is the worst kept secret that JYP Entertainment, like their other peers in the industry, are looking to expand in the Latin American mm-hmm. market. And so this, I think, is a great tease, a great start to say that, look, we're here, this is real, let's get it on. So yeah.
Lots for Latin American fans to look forward to. Well, that wraps up this week's edition of Hallyu Highlights. A big thank you to Bernie Cho for guiding us through the biggest stories and buzz in Korean entertainment. Always great to have you with us, Bernie.
Always good to be here.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24. Don't forget to tune in again tomorrow. We've got more stories, interviews and insights you won't want to miss. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thanks for joining me and goodbye.
What you're about to hear could save a life. These are step-by-step instructions for performing CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation, a life-saving emergency procedure used when a person's heart is not functioning properly. First, if someone collapses and is unresponsive, ensure the scene is safe. Tap the patient's shoulder and shout, "Are you okay?" If the person remains unresponsive, if their breathing is abnormal, or if there are any signs of a seizure, immediately call 119 or your local emergency number or point out someone nearby to make the call. The faster you call, the better. You can also make a video call or send photos to the local emergency number. Start CPR immediately rather than leaving the scene to find someone else for help or looking for a pulse. Place the heel of your dominant hand in the center of the person's chest. Place your other hand on top, keep your arms straight, and press hard and fast. Press hard and fast at a rate of 100 to 120 compressions per minute. That's the beat of Stayin' Alive playing right now. Push in at least 2 inches or 5 centimeters and allow the chest to rise fully between compressions. If you are not trained and are not confident in rescue breathing, continue hands-only CPR until emergency medical personnel arrive. Immediate CPR can help maintain blood flow to the brain and vital organs. Acting quickly may save a life. This has been a public safety message on CPR. KBS World Radio is committed to keeping our listeners informed and prepared because knowing what to do in an emergency makes all the difference. Stay safe, stay informed.
KBS World Radio.